Making downtown Seattle feel safe has been an ongoing issue, and every so often we check in with other cities to see how they handle that issue, and in this case, Minneapolis and their prolific offenders. We called up Ron Cunningham, city probation officer in Minneapolis, and he explained how he, along with two city attorneys and some cooperative police officers and some social services groups, sit down at the table, come together to try to solve this problem.
You know, we track all sorts of stuff, you know, from their number of arrests or number of police contacts to number of, you know, detox admissions, number of hospitalizations. And then we also started tracking, did they receive chemical health services? Did we get them connected with mental health services? Did we get them into some sort of housing? But we've had a reduction in recidivism on some of these individuals upwards of 70%.
That's pretty good. Does it save you money, or do you end up spending that money by having to hire more probation officers?
Well, I am the only probation officer in Hennepin County that does this. So,
really?
No, we've not spent more money on that. And I think in the long term, yes, we're saving money. At the end of the day, none of this is free and none of it is cheap. But if you look at an individual that is arrested and, you know, that involves, you know, officer time, that involve, if they get booked into jail, you know, there's a cost related to that. Or if there's involvement with law enforcement, there's a cost for that. There's a cost for the transport to detox. There's a cost for the 3 days that they spend in detox. Everything adds up. We had a few folks that we would call were in the $1 million club that over time, you know, cost the various resources in the city of Minneapolis roughly $1 million a person.
Wow.
So there is definitely a cost savings and trying to utilize some other resources other than jail. And there's also a cost savings, I think, when businesses and other folks feel more comfortable in coming downtown and spending money and being out and about in an area of Minneapolis that in the past they had stayed away from.
And the whole idea here is to make sure that, because for example, right now we'll arrest somebody and it'll get written up, but then they'll be released and will never show up for the court date. So
right.
You're able to make sure they show up.
Well, to as much as we can, yes. Nothing is a perfect system. So on a normal misdemeanor, say a public urination or something like that, they'll get a year of probation, 90 days stayed time. So a lot of these folks will plead to get out of jail. They'll agree to be on probation. And it's not uncommon that, especially the first few times that, you know, I'm working with them, they will, you know, they will not follow through and call me. And then so we pick them up a second time and say, you know, here's the deal. You're on probation. You agreed to this. And this is what we're going to do. If you don't want to do this, then you can just go ahead and, you know, execute your time and go to the workhouse. The problem is when you get out in 60 days or whatever credit you have, you know, I guess my approach is always what's different? What is going to change? I try to connect with, you know, these folks at some point in time. And, you know, sometimes initially that's a struggle. You know, they're transient. A lot of them don't have any contact information. They don't have a phone. No permanent address. Thankfully, you know, the city of Minneapolis, and part of that it comes with the relationship with the police department, is we know where they're going to go. So if we get a warrant, then it's just information that we pass on to the officers in the precinct and say, go out and look for this individual. He's got a warrant. And
it's so it sounds like you all work together then.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's why, you know, there's only one of me. I use a lot of resources and relationships with other agencies. We brought all of us other agencies to the table and kind of a joint effort on, you know, how do we address this? And the cops were tired of arresting and having folks being released and nothing happens. And, you know, the same, even if they were held for a week, they're out there a week later. So that's where I kind of came in. And sometimes we up the ante. I'll let a guy will plead to one misdemeanor. He'll get arrested shortly down the road. He'll pick up a second misdemeanor. That will get sentenced consecutively. So now we have 180 days versus 90 days.
So it sounds like you hold them accountable. There's no such thing as saying, okay, we'll just have to learn to tolerate this behavior.
Right.
And you have all the other organizations, including the nonprofit charities, are on board with this approach.
Absolutely, yes.
Was that tough to do?
Probably. I think our toughest sell might have been some of the human services agencies that, you know, had street outreach workers or whatever. Yeah. And you know, they have a relationship with their clients, and their, I think their initial view on, you know, law enforcement or probation was certainly not warm and fuzzy. But I think once they saw what we were trying to do, and I would say this to so many people, that if you could sit through one of our, we have weekly strategy meetings at the precinct, and if you could sit through one of these meetings and listen to this, you know, to the discussion between human services, probation, law enforcement, attorneys, we're not just out, you know, trying to put people in jail. We're collectively trying to figure out, what do we do with somebody and how do we get there? And we start talking about housing and we start sharing information and, you know, good information and bad information. And law enforcement is out there every day. And, you know, they know these individuals, and they're the first ones to tell me that, A, you know, I saw this individual down on 9th and Nicollet and he was drunk, or they're going to tell me, I saw him on 9th and Nicollet, he was sober, I talked with him, he looks good, it looks like we're making some progress. What do we do next? How do we approach this? So I think once the human services agencies that we were working with saw that, you know, that's what we're trying to do, then I think pretty much everybody got on the same page and said, let's do what we can.
Okay, well, now here's the other thing, and I heard this through a third party, that Minneapolis does such a good job at providing services that these people need that you actually are now attracting people who need these services to the city. Is that true?
Well, you know, occasionally you hear that. And, yeah, you get a handful that come from, you know, kind of really all over, whether it's Chicago or Gary or down south. But you also get a relatively large number of folks that were basically born and raised in Minneapolis or in Minnesota. And I always, you know, I'll tell people that, you know, there is no Homelessville, USA. That isn't where these folks come from. I meet, you know, I just had a meeting yesterday with a client that, you know, basically born and raised and went to high school here in Minneapolis. And at some point, some life circumstance or series of circumstances, whether it was being young and being incarcerated or having a, you know, a mental health issue or coupled with a chemical health issue, and now he's 40 years old and he spent the last 12 years, you know, living on the street. So, yeah, I'm sure we get some, but I don't know that number. And it's hard for me to believe that someone would travel from a great distance to receive, you know, a monthly stipend of $200. I don't think that's realistic. But again, maybe there's a population that does that, but I can't say for sure.
Ron Cunningham is a probation officer in downtown Minneapolis. He's responsible for what are called the Downtown 100. Ron, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Ron is in town along with a small Minneapolis delegation. We'll have a forum tonight at Axis at Pioneer Square to discuss these issues. Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. After many years on the market, a very important drug is pulled because of a cancer risk. Let's consult the doctor.
Agent Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. We're referring here to Zantac, which is an anti-heartburn pill, right? And this has been around since 1981, and so they suddenly find that it's a cancer risk?
Zantac is actually sort of a revolutionary drug. Zantac, you know, it's an anti-heartburn drug, but it actually suppresses the secretion of acid from the stomach. And prior to 1981, the treatment was surgery. So it was a drug that basically replaced the need for surgery. And there's operations that, you know, I learned about during my general surgery residency that disappeared as a result of this whole class of drugs being developed. And it's been in the news a lot lately, because the FDA has recalled it because it has a chemical in it called NDMA. And NDMA is known to be carcinogenic. Hmm. Now, it has very, very, very low levels of it.
And now, while just because it's going to make some people nervous who are taking other brands of drug that do similar things, right? Like Prilosec, I think it is.
Right. So that's a different drug.
Different drug.
Different class of drugs.
So it doesn't even, this concern does not apply to that.
What's happened is there's been a number of medications that have actually been recalled from the market. And what's sort of an underlying commonality between them is that they are contaminated with either NDMA or related chemicals such as NDEA, is used to make rocket fuel and can also be found in some food and drinking water at low levels. But it can also be created through certain chemical reactions, which is what's happening here, as a byproduct of the industrial process.
Oh, I see. So this is not like they were making it too near a rocket fuel factory or something.
No. This is okay. A byproduct of the of the process. And actually, the amount of NDMA found in these recalled drugs is tiny, but it exceeds what are considered to be acceptable levels. So it's not necessarily dating all the way back to the beginning of when the drug was first formed, but there were changes in the way that the pharmaceutical industry manufactured these different drugs. Some of it also has to do with not only the change in how it was being made, but the change in where it was being made. There's some others that have been in the news recently that are related to blood pressure. And so, for example, people may have heard that Valsartan has been recalled, and it was recalled in the past year. Losartan was recalled in December.
For the same reason? Contaminants?
Yeah, for the same reason. And really sort of the common thread among all these recalls is that these drugs or the ingredients in the drugs were all made in India or China.
Really?
So, yeah. You know, we're now taking chemicals from different countries to create generics and keep the cost.
But when you make a big change like that, you change where the drug's manufactured, don't you have to go through some sort of testing before you can sell it?
I mean, we buy drugs from made all over the world and have been for years.
But I thought one of the reasons, for example, we don't want to re-import drugs from Canada is the danger of contamination. We're worried about drugs from Canada. But you're telling me we've been importing drugs from China and India without checking them out first?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, American drug companies really since the 1990s have increasingly used factories in other countries to manufacture their products. So currently in this country, about 40% of our finished medications are actually made overseas. And about 8 out of 10 of the active pharmaceutical ingredients are purchased from overseas. So sort of this globalization of the nation's drug supply, it helps to keep prices down, which is good because one of the big issues we're always faced with is the high cost of medical care. And it's cheaper to have these drugs made in other countries. But with lower costs, we, you know, sometimes have lower quality control.
Hmm. Are drugs labeled? I mean, every time I buy a shirt, it tells me where it's made. But I've never seen anything on my prescription drug bottles that tells me where it was made.
Yeah, you know, you're saying that now. Actually, now that I think about it, you're correct. I have never seen that myself either. You know, the FDA is trying to figure out, you know, how to deal with this. But, I mean, really what I think most experts are saying now is that anyone who's taking a recalled drug really should actually continue to do so. But you need to talk to your physician and or your pharmacist and see if there's other options out there, because it's important to understand that actually the threat of not taking the drug may actually be greater than the threat of taking the drug. And that's the whole thing in medicine. It's about comparing risks versus reward. And in this case, the reward may be still greater than the risk that's associated with it. But these drugs are not going to come off the market altogether. These blood pressure medications are going to be back on the market. Zantac and ranitidine are going to stay on the market. I feel certain of it. It's just how it gets produced and where it gets produced is what's most likely to change.
So bottom line is relax, despite what you're hearing. And if you have trouble relaxing, there's always Valium.
Yep, there is.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen.
Thanks, Dave.
Ted Ross is calling up Brian, Chris Sullivan, and Hannah Scott has joined us this morning. Just as we try to get a handle on the opioid epidemic, a reminder that meth is still here. And does this mean there has to be a whole new plan for dealing with that? Is there a whole new plan for dealing with
that? And there's not. And that's part of the problem. Meth use has quietly snuck back in and kind of taken over the last few years. It's really big across the country in various cities. And of course, here in King County and Seattle. In fact, last year, the overdose deaths, those involving meth surpassed those involving heroin. But there's right now what we do for heroin and other opioids, Seattle and King County have invested millions to expand access to medication-assisted treatment, which is Suboxone and methadone and things like that. And that's helped to level off the overdose deaths when we talk about opioids. But there's really nothing like it when it comes to meth. Now, public health consultant Chris Narup says experts are trying to come up with something, though, to address that issue using some kind of a similar method.
Looking at substances that are basically equivalent to methamphetamine, such as Adderall or Ritalin, and taking folks who are using meth and giving them a prescription pharmaceutical instead of a street pharmaceutical and seeing if that would be effective.
For anybody who doesn't know, Adderall or Ritalin is what we give kids for attention deficit disorder. And he says one of the reasons that that idea is getting some traction is that medical experts know in many cases people using illegal drugs like meth are self-medicating.
So there are folks who are using methamphetamine who, if they actually went to a doctor, would probably receive a diagnosis of attention deficit disorder or some other condition for which Ritalin or Adderall would actually be prescribed. So certainly for those individuals, this seems like a logical course of action.
So what they want to do, they're asking the city for to fund a pilot program to kind of research this and see if it will help. There's backing from a doctor at Harborview. And he says one of the reasons they think it would help those not just who would get that prescription if they went to a doctor on their own, but it could help others. And he says most people using meth are smoking it or injecting it right now if they're on the street. So that's another reason this could help.
Smoking a drug is the fastest way to get high. Injecting is the second fastest way to get high. And so people that are using illicitly are tending to smoke or inject the drug. If we can get folks to stop doing that and to take a once or twice a day pill, you're also immediately reducing the harm. And from a public safety standpoint, they're no longer using in public. And they're no longer buying illegal drugs and contributing to an illegal drug market.
Why don't these people go to a doctor?
Why don't they go to a doctor?
Yeah.
Meth users? Because they, to try to get Ritalin or something?
Well, what he's saying is that these are people who would normally go to a doctor and would be prescribed this.
Some, but he's also saying those who are just using meth might also benefit from this other drug because it's a kind of a harm reduction thing. It's not as damaging. It's not shown medically to really cause any damage to your body or do anything negative to you. Whereas meth, absolutely will. Meth also has other side effects.
No, I know meth is really bad, but we're now coming to accept the fact that there are people who have to self-medicate, right?
Right.
So the idea is to get them to self-medicate the right way instead of the wrong way?
Yeah, absolutely. And this would be something, again, like we do with Suboxone, where we take it out to treatment centers and places like that. And, you know, there are a variety of reasons people won't go to the doctor from the get-go on their own like this to try to get Ritalin. One could be health insurance problems. You know what I mean?
Well, now, see, that's what I was wondering. Now, if it's that, then the answer is to make sure everybody's got health insurance. Because if all these we have too much stuff that could be handled in a doctor's office or an emergency room playing out on the street. That's the problem, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, yes. And so, like right now, what they do with Suboxone, once they get you into treatment, you're signed up for Apple Health. You get Medicaid and it's covered. So you may have to get to that. They haven't gotten to that point with this yet, but it does have some backing. The other person backing this pilot program is Lisa Howard. She's with the Alliance for Pioneer Square, and this is why she needs it.
I want to be ahead of it. I don't want it to get to the point where it's a critical issue that everyone is surprised by. I think there's some indicators of some more aggressive behaviors in the situations that we're hearing from on the streets across Seattle, not even specifically in Pioneer Square, although we have our fair share of.
So she's talking about the prolific offenders that are across Seattle. So a lot of the people that we've heard about recently with random assaults, stabbing in front of Nordstrom's a few months back, the pitchfork attack at a Ballard post office, all those folks had meth in their system. So there's a sense of urgency among the people proposing this pilot. They'd asked the mayor to fund this in her budget. She did not. She wants to look at this more holistically, and there needs to be discussions on how to do this along with our Suboxone treatment. But there is somebody on the city council right now who might try to wiggle it in the budget. We'll have to see how that goes.
All right. Karen is Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Time for your dose of kindness, which I do believe we include in the podcast version of Seattle's Morning News.
We do.
So we also have a podcast of the show. By day, she is executive producer of special projects over at Q13. But Bhavisha Patel has another job. She's a kindness warrior.
It started several years ago. I would always write notes on airplanes and hide them in a magazine just because I know traveling can be stressful for people. But if it helps one person, smile or makes their day better, then I've done my job.
It's now her signature move. Leave a random note with an encouraging or kind phrase for a complete stranger to find. Not knowing Bavisha personally, but kind of following her kindness journey online, I had to ask what inspired her to be so unselfishly kind to complete strangers.
I've been through some difficult times, so I know what it's like to feel like you're not important and you're not worth anything. And it's important to be reminded once in a while that, you know, you are important and your presence in this world makes a difference.
Bavisha admits she's needed that kind of kindness at points in her life, too, and strangers have answered that call. So she knows how it feels to be lifted up. That's why this year she's decided to up her game.
So my birthday was on Tuesday, and I just thought, what can I do this year? For what gift can I give to the world? And I just decided to start writing kind notes. It could be three words. Like yesterday's was, you are worthy. Leave these notes in random places for people to find as they're going about their days. And it's true that 99% of people will be like, eh, I don't really care about this. But, you know, if one person smiles, it was worth it.
She started the Twitter handle, A Kind Note, and is now posting about each note she leaves around the region. She's inspired others to join, too, some leaving kindness notes on Bavisha's behalf on parking meters, at the scene of a house fire, even. It's incredible to see kindness spreading on the very platform, Twitter, that we can arguably be the worst to each other.
There's so much negativity in the world on social media and just in general, and we're heading into an election year where we're going to be a little bit more divided. And so if we can just do a simple thing, I mean, it takes me 30 seconds to write a nice note to somebody, then we should do that.
You can follow Bavisha Patel on Twitter and follow her kindness note campaign. It's called A Kind Note. I also want to give a quick shout out to Principal Walton at Maplewood Elementary. Go Mustangs in Puyallup. She wrote me looking to where she can find my stories about kindness. I'd mentioned we include them in the podcast version of Seattle's Morning News. She wants to share some of those stories with her kids at school. It's really important for them to talk about kindness, how to do it, and, mm-hmm. and just lift students up in that way. So thank you for listening, Principal Walton.
It's time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here he is, Danny O'Neill. Boy, I was worried in the beginning there. Were you worried in the beginning there?
Yeah, sure. It was very typical Seahawks game, right? It starts out exceptionally frustrating. You wonder exactly when they showed up, if they got the wrong time for the game start, or what in the world's going on. Then they start rallying. They put themselves together, and you're like, all right. This seems like it's going to be, well, I think they got control of this. Then something inexplicable happens. In this case, it was a CJ ProSize fumble. And then it comes down to the wire, and you end up sweating out your Sunday morning, or I guess early afternoon in this case. And it comes through, and you're like, I don't know if they're any good or not, but they're certainly taking years off my life.
You know what I didn't question, though, is how good Russell Wilson is.
Russell is fantastic. 207 straight pass attempts going back to the final game, final regular season game of last year without being picked off. He broke his own franchise record. He now has the three longest interceptionless streaks in franchise history, which is pretty darn remarkable.
Yeah, and running for a touchdown as well. I mean, he just looked good.
He's looked great. And the difference between the Seahawks and the Browns yesterday really came down to not just the plays the quarterbacks made, because Baker Mayfield did make some plays, so the mistakes they didn't. Mayfield was picked off three times. Not all of those were his fault. But, yeah, that was the difference, was the mistakes that the Browns made.
Yeah. I like to, during the games, say things like, boy, we could sure use a turnover on this play. And darn it, I was right a couple of times.
See, there you go. The Browns turned it over enough that, like, your odds
yeah,
were fairly
that's what
decent.
I figured.
But, look, the top stat that correlates with winning, Dave, you'll be surprised to hear this, is points.
Really?
The team that has more points almost invariably wins.
I'll try that
the
next
The second
time.
Most. Like, the number two is turnovers. It's the most predictive stat in all of football is whoever has the most takeaways in the game, whoever has a positive turnover differential, that they get more turnovers than they commit, that is the most consistent predictor of victories.
Speaking of points, nice job on the point spread. You said 27-23, mm-hmm. right? So you're just off by 5 points on each side, but you got the spread. So nice job on your prediction.
Yeah, do you think that's skill, Dave?
Yeah, I do.
No, it's not. It's luck. It's blind luck.
Oh, you think that I thought the game was going to go that way?
You think that I thought the Seahawks were going to walk around for about, I don't know, the first 16 minutes completely unable to stop them? Or that they win by 4 points despite forcing just two punts?
Don't admit that.
It's blind luck.
Well, how you feeling?
File it next to blind squirrels and broken clocks.
Danny, how are you feeling about this team? Because, you know, I read your headline at MyNorthwest.com that said the Seahawks didn't beat themselves, which to me sounds a little bit more on the pessimistic side of the headlines instead of, hey, you know, we're what, 5-1 now? That's great.
Colleen, do the writers write their headlines?
Oh, sorry.
I wrote that very sentence in the story. I think that's a pretty accurate summary of how
me.
I feel. I think that's a pretty accurate. No, I don't know if they're any good or not.
Really?
I honestly don't. I know that their quarterback is one of the two best guys going in football right now. I know that. I don't know if that's enough to take them and make them a more legitimate Super Bowl contender than they were a year ago. I don't think their defense is very good. There wasn't much that led you to believe that they were good yesterday other than the fact that they got some turnovers, which really I chalk up more to the Browns than I do to the Seahawks in those games. I don't think they've looked particularly good through six games. I also think that historically, Pete Carroll's teams get better with time, and if this team gets better and is already 5-1, if that's their record, and then they start playing good, they should be in really strong position when the playoffs start. But there's no guarantee they're going to start playing better, because I don't think overall, other than Russell Wilson, this team's played particularly good so far.
Well, your new favorite player, Tedrick Thompson, looked good again yesterday. Bobby Wagner's pep talk apparently made a difference. So, I mean, the fact that they stick with it and they hang in there and they don't panic, even though there were some reasons to panic, that's a good sign, isn't it?
It is a very good sign. And look, the maybe the most consistent way to win in the NFL is to let other teams beat themselves. And Cleveland's not ready to play the kind of mistake-free football that you need to play to win. Let another team beat itself. If you don't have to beat them, that's just all the easier for you, right?
Yeah.
How worried should we be that Will Disley is hurt?
Yeah.
It's a bummer. And I always look at these things. I think strategically, the biggest issue is for him. It just stinks. He's now, it's his second year and it's second season ending injury. Mm. He tore a patellar tendon last year, which is really tough to come back from. Now he's torn Achilles tendon. It's really sad. I feel really bad for him. We'll see how Seattle is able to sort of deal with his absence. And I actually think that Luke Wilson gives them a shot. They're certainly not going to be better for it, but then Ed Dixon will have a chance to come back as well. I just feel really bad for him.
Danny O'Neill, 710 ESPN Seattle. Our Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Turkey is vowing to press on against Kurdish militias who fought alongside the U.S. military in the battle against ISIS. Let's bring in CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausin. First, I want to get something straight here. I've seen quotes saying that Donald Trump now believes that the Turkish president broke a promise. What can you tell me about that?
Well, I hadn't heard that, but it certainly may be the case. I mean, the president did, in fact, say that in the call that he had, and subsequently on a Twitter, he said that, of course, if Turkey did anything which he considered off limits, he would, and I'm quoting now from that tweet, obliterate the Turkish economy, which is not exactly the language one uses when talking about a NATO ally. That came out, I believe, on Tuesday following the rather precipitous phone call he had with Erdogan a week ago Sunday. And certainly it doesn't seem now that the attack is unfolding by the Turks that this would be considered within the limits of any really thoughtful policy for the United States.
They seem to be occupying Syrian territory at this point. Is this a temporary thing, or are they sort of creating their own buffer zone of some kind?
They're creating their own buffer zone, without a doubt. They're talking about an area about 300 miles wide and about 20 to 30 miles deep. And part of the reason they're doing that is Erdogan wants to expel somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 3.5 million Syrian refugees who have been on Turkish territory as part and parcel of this ongoing about eight-year-long civil war in Syria. But what has complicated this even more overnight is the Syrian Democratic Forces, once they were in essence abandoned by the U.S. allies, have now turned to President Assad of Syria and his Russian patrons, and apparently they have cut a deal whereby they're now going to allow Syrian government forces to come in the area, bolster their defenses in response to this Turkish offensive. So as we're speaking, we have the distinct possibility of a direct confrontation between the Syrian army of the government of Assad and the Turkish army right there on the border with the Russians involved as the backers of the Syrians.
So just let me get this straight. Would this would be sort of like us deciding to occupy part of Mexico and forcing refugees to go there?
That would be exactly right. If we were to take over a large portion of Mexico and then, say, force out a whole bunch of people we consider to be illegal aliens or detainees or refugees and force them back there, you just have to add that the Russians would be a Mexican ally and would have Russian military forces on Mexican territory to make the metaphor really correct.
Okay, so what is Russia's interest here? What are they likely to do?
Well, Russia has been a strong backer of President Assad throughout this particular civil war. Have large military forces, a lot of air support they provide the Syrian military. And what they want to do, I think, is really two things. One, they want to be declared a major player in the Middle East. And now with the United States pulling out, they certainly seem to be a major player. It's interesting, President Putin, while this was all going on over the weekend, was in Saudi Arabia, meeting with the Saudis, and by one announcement seemed very well pleased by the U.S. withdrawal. Secondly, I believe they've got their eyes on very rich oil reserves and natural gas reserves that are present in northeastern Syria, an area that's been occupied by the Kurds who live there. And recently they've carved out an autonomous region in that portion of Syria during this long-standing civil war in the country.
Okay, to look at this from the president's point of view, there are a lot of people who wonder why we are so embedded in the Middle East, especially now that we can satisfy our own oil needs without help from Mideast oil. I understand that we have allies who depend on that oil, but his view seems to be, okay, if Europe depends on that oil, then why doesn't Europe pony up and spend more on defense and Europe take care of this region?
Well, that's a fair argument. This is one the president has made since he ran for office about getting us out of these so-called endless wars. It goes without saying, though, that the Europeans have been involved. They were in the coalition with us against ISIS. And when the president made this precipitous announcement, there were also some special operations forces from the UK and France in this area. And apparently we didn't announce that to them either. Mm. But, you know, the United States had a modest force in the region where the offensive is going of somewhere between 50 and 100 special operations troops, which really were a tripwire to deter a Syrian invasion and a wider war, which is what we have right now. You might say the metaphor there would be we've had 28,000 troops in Korea since 1950 to deter an all-out war, and for that investment we have caused that not to occur. Secondly, of course, it seems to be in the interest of the United States not only to secure the oil supplies for our allies, whose major economies actually fuel the United States, despite the fact you're right, Dave, we have our own oil, but furthermore, we have an interest in defeating ISIS. And the problem is that the war with ISIS, despite what Mr. Trump says, is far from over. There are about 70,000 ISIS detainees and their families in camps controlled by the Syrian Democratic Forces. About four of those large camps are in the area where the Turks are going in. And over the last few days, there's been repeated announcements about a number of those people now escaping, and the possibility of an ISIS resurgence seems much more likely today than it was last week.
Not good. CBS analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Jeff, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Susan Rice is the former National Security Advisor under President Obama, 27th Ambassador to the UN. She now holds positions at Harvard, American University, writes for the New York Times. She'll also be talking about her book, Tough Love, tonight at 7:30 at Town Hall. And Susan, before we talk about the book, I have to ask you, what did you think about President Trump's claim that his own people have been spying on him? They raised concerns about a phone call, but instead of going to him, they go to a CIA officer, and he considers that spying. What do you think about that?
Dave, that's not spying. That's being a patriot, looking out for the interests of our government and our Constitution. You know, the notion that anybody who expresses concern about any aspect of the president's behavior, particularly in this case when the president is plainly acting in his own personal political interest rather than the national interest, is somehow a spy or a traitor, or worse, is absurd and offensive to the many dedicated public servants who are career officials who are just trying to do their best for the country they love. So I think it's obvious to most Americans that terms like spy and traitor are distractions and distortions and really unfair to the men and women who are standing up for what is right. We have whistleblowers and whistleblower protections for the very reason to ensure responsible government accountability and transparency. And that's what these officials, whoever they were doing.
I assume you were on phone calls that President Obama made to world leaders, correct?
Absolutely.
Were you familiar at all with the negotiations between Vice President Biden and the Ukrainian administration at the time, where it appeared anyway that our support was contingent on them doing something about pursuing corruption?
Yes. So let me explain this to your listeners. In 2014 and 15, when the government changed in Ukraine and we had a democratically elected government that had been invaded by Russia, the United States and Europe and the international financial institutions were trying to shore up this brand new democratic government with assistance to help them defend themselves against Russia, as well as economic assistance. And that economic assistance could only be effective in the context of the government trying to seriously root out corruption, which is has been endemic in Ukraine. So Vice President Biden, on behalf of the U.S. government and on behalf of President Obama, and in support of what was clearly bipartisan United States policy in conjunction with our European allies, was pressing the leadership and the new president in Ukraine to get rid of a corrupt prosecutor general, the equivalent of our attorney general, who rather than rooting out corruption was aiding and abetting it. So that's what Vice President Biden did, and he was doing it at the behest of the U.S. government, fully transparently. That's very different than what we've learned that President Trump was doing, which was holding up military aid, $400 million, to a country that's still facing a Russian occupation, and withholding a White House visit in order to extort out of the now another new Ukrainian president false information on President Trump's perceived political opponent, Joe Biden. The extraordinary thing about that phone call was there was no business done on behalf of the United States government. It was purely President Trump asking the new president, Zelensky, for dirt to help him smear his political opponent. And then subsequently, the record of that call was hidden away in a place where it wasn't meant to receive the light of day. So they're two very different circumstances that the president has tried to conflate and equate, but there's no real equation between them at all.
But back to the Biden negotiations to remove this prosecutor. At the time, his son Hunter was on the board of directors of one of the companies being investigated, correct?
Well, actually, yes, Hunter Biden was on the board, but that company was not being investigated by the prosecutor general at that point. So that's another distortion that unfortunately has gained currency because the president is trying to confuse the American public about it.
Does that create, would it create in your mind, an appearance of a conflict of interest for the vice president's son to be on that board at all, whether it was being investigated or not?
Well, I don't know that it creates an appearance of a conflict of interest if it's out in the open and in the public domain, which it was at the time. I think what we have seen President Trump do effectively is take an issue which is perceived to be a weakness of his own, the perception, for example, that the Trump family and the Trump empire and the president himself, along with his kids, while the president is in office, is continuing to behave in ways that have been accused of being corrupt or in self-enriching, and turn that weakness against his opponent, trying to make it Joe Biden's weakness. Nobody has ever before accused Joe Biden of being in any way, shape, or form corrupt, in part because he's not, but in part also because, as everybody in Washington knows, he was the poorest member of the United States Senate for most of his tenure. So what Trump has done is you know, an effective ploy that he's done in the past, turning his weakness into his opponent's weakness, or trying to do so. But I think the important thing here is, you know, we could debate the wisdom of Hunter Biden serving on such a board, but there was nothing secret or hidden about it. It was out in the open and known to all at the time.
Yes. Oh, believe me, I recognize the irony of a president who has set all his kids up in businesses criticizing somebody else for having a son who was on the board of another business. But nevertheless, it does seem to come up. So I'm just curious, as somebody who, I mean, you joined the Clinton administration when you were in your 20s, and you're clearly an overachiever. but you've ended up in the center of some really thorny situations, Benghazi, this kind of thing. Do you ever regret having to have so much on your plate? It just seems like, after a while, who needs all this?
Well, Dave, I appreciate the sentiment behind the question. You know, I spend a good bit of time in my new book explaining how I became interested in public service. It comes from my family. It comes from my upbringing. And I also describe, in very personal terms, how I was born, how I was raised, how I experienced that service. To be very honest, as frustrating and painful as some of the attacks on me were in the wake of Benghazi, I would not trade the opportunity to serve our country for anything.
Susan Rice, former National Security Advisor under President Obama, she'll be at Town Hall tonight talking about her book, Tough Love. Interview by Sally Jewell, who's from Seattle, of course, and former Secretary of the Interior. Susan, great to talk with you, and thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dave. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.